So you're experiencing snow in Santa Fe. That's a lovely thing.
Well, we've had quite a bit of snow this year, so, you know, it's very much needed, so, you know, nobody is complaining about it.
Yeah, the same here. We need it, too. Is snow in that ancient city an inspirational thing for a nouveau flamenco guitar player?
I think in the sense that it creates a blank canvas. You know, I don't have art on the wall of my house. They're just plain white because I like to just imagine things myself. And so the snow is sort of the same thing. It blankets everything, and you feel like you know you have a fresh start.
Interesting.
It leaves more room for imagination, just sort of like the desert does, you know.
Well, you know, I can't imagine too many other Santa Feans saying there's no art on their walls. That's kind of counterintuitive.
Well, you know, Santa Fe does have a huge art market. And we do actually now have a few more modern places as well, like Site Santa Fe, which always has incredible shows. So it's not just all the same type of Santa Fe paintings anymore.
Now, you've been a resident of Santa Fe for some 30 years, I think. Is Santa Fe particularly fertile ground for what you do?
I think in the sense that people here have been mixing up different cultures for a long, long time. You know, you find restaurants here doing all kinds of interesting East-West experiments. You know, I think what I noticed when I came here in around 86, 87, I remember being in a bar, and there was a trio playing, and it was a flamenco guitar player, a classical violinist, and a banjo player. And I thought, you know, I've never, ever heard that kind of mix anywhere in the world. And, you know, I found it really interesting. And so when you listen to Nuevo Flamenco, you actually hear, you know, from Spain, there is the rumba, the flamenco rumba strum. But in Barcelona Nights, for example, the umpa bass or the melody, that's very, very mariachi, very Mexican. And those are two of the important cultural elements here beside the Native American and then everything else.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the history of flamenco, that's a little bit of a mongrel genre anyway in its roots, isn't it?
I think every good genre is a mongrel experience. I mean, you could make the case for food. I mean, if you go to California or even in Colorado and New Mexico, you know, the food is a mix of, you know, stuff from all over the world. If you look at California cuisine, what does that mean? You know, it's Asian, it's Mediterranean, it's Mexican, it's a whole bunch of different things. And if you look at jazz, same thing. So most people don't know this, but as you said, flamenco has actually a lot of different influences. I'd say if you're looking at traditional flamenco, then probably 70% of that is from the Arabic culture, which was in Spain for, you know, hundreds of years. And in fact, some of the rhythms, you know, are not rhythms that are played anywhere else in Europe. But if you played it with a percussionist, say, from Iraq, they would know exactly those rhythms because they're Arabic rhythms. There's also a whole other group of flamenco rhythms that comes from the Caribbean. Those include tangos flamenco and rumba. They were actually brought to Spain by sailors from the Caribbean. So, you know, like all the good things, it's a mix of a whole bunch of different cultures.
You were born and grew up in Germany. How did a good German boy get on to the flamenco playing, the flamenco idea?
Well, you know, I think it's a little parallel to a good English boy like Eric Clapton playing the blues, you know.
Oh.
You just hear these things and they just speak to you. And then you follow that trail and pick up things. And, it's really no different from a European, you know, playing the blues.
So when you were following that trail, who was the first giant that you encountered that inspired you?
Well, I think I was around 15 when I went, 15 when I went to a concert that really greatly influenced me. And it was, the opening act was Earth, Wind, and Fire, which sounds like already a great evening. But then the main artist, the headliner was Santana. So it remains to this day one of the greatest concerts I've ever seen. And I think that Santana melodic influence, I hear it in a lot of places of my songs and my playing, that importance of the melody that ties everything together. Another one was a couple years later, this friend of mine showed me an album. And one of the guitar players turned out to be Paco de Lucía, and that was the first time I heard of him. And so that was something, another little cookie I followed, a little trail to discover his playing. So you just pick up different things as you move on.
What distinguishes Nouveau Flamenco from old flamenco? Is it just the fact that that you have accompanists, you know, a band, basically?
No, because I think that exists. I had to come up with an album title real quick, and I think I was reading in a newspaper something about nouvelle cuisine, and I thought, you know, just put a French word in front of it, you know, just to show that it's not traditional flamenco. And that was really my thinking. It wasn't very deep thinking. It just sort of, you know, I had to come up with something. And that was it. I think, you know, my music includes a lot of different stuff. I do play a flamenco guitar, which is a specific, you know, design that's different from classical guitars, even though they both have nylon strings. And I use a lot of flamenco techniques, but the music has evolved into something quite different.
Because of the presence of a band, or not?
Well, because of the band, and also because of, you know, I am not, you know, I love a lot of the traditional flamenco stuff, but I'm not really that interested in it because I want to create some things that are more uniquely me and not follow a tradition so much. So the tradition was more of a jumping board for me to start with.
As it is, I think, with a lot of people who sort of create their own genre. You know, I'm thinking, for instance, of Newgrass Revival. They built on bluegrass,
sure,
and took it in a totally different direction, just as you did.
Oh, sure. And to go back to the guy I mentioned earlier, I mean, Carlos Santana, that genre didn't exist. You know, to mix blues and Latin in such a way that had never been done before. I mean, that was uniquely, you know, his thing, which I think is really cool. I think it's one of the things that seems to happen a little less nowadays. Maybe it's just my age speak coming through, but it seems to me that the 70s and the 60s were a lot more adventurous than we are today.
Do you think that might be because of technology?
I think it might be in part just because of, you know, it's much harder to make a living as a musician. I think we'll discover that probably 10 years down the line when there's going to be a lot less younger musicians because they're going, I can't make a living at this. So I think it's a whole bunch of different things that come together. I think the technology in itself, you know, if you mean recording technology, that, I think, has been absorbed and, you know, people know what they can do with the technology. And in some cases, it actually makes their lives a lot easier. Like, you know, I'm able to record everything by myself now. I have a remote control in my recording studio, and I can start and stop the computer and, You know, it's made my life a lot easier. If you mean other technologies like streaming and file sharing and things like that, yeah, that's definitely made things easier, harder for people. That's
well,
for sure.
On the blog section of your website, you talk a little bit. Pardon me. You talk a little bit about streaming and how it. Uh-huh. You just mentioned how it's hard to make a living, and I was shocked to discover what was your statistic. You have to have 300,000 streams to make minimum wage.
380,000 streams to make minimum wage. Yeah. So that's, you know, the more established musicians can get gigs. You know, the problem is if somebody gets, injured, then, you know, they can't tour necessarily anymore. And that becomes difficult. I mean, there's a reason why Tom Petty was on a stage, even though he had broken his hip and was using opioids, you know, in order to make it through the gig. He, you know, his income from record sales probably plunged like with everybody else. Mm-hmm. So it's creating a whole bunch of new problems. But yeah, when you think about it, 380,000 streams to get minimum wage, when you see how much money people at Spotify earn, and Spotify and Amazon just are basically suing to get lower songwriter royalties in order to make even more money. So yeah, it's interesting times, as they say.
Yes, indeed, we're blessed to be in them, I guess. So what I hear you saying is that it's the live gig that is your bread and butter.
Yes, everybody's.
Uh huh.
So I mean, the good part is that a lot of people are out there touring, and there's a lot of great concerts to be had, you know, that part is really great. I think there is still a real interest in live music, you know, and it seems like, judging by the sold-out concerts that we had in February, that there is a real place for simple performances, meaning, you know, no backing tracks, no video screen, no laser lights, just, you know, a few guys on a stage making some music. So that's really great. That's really a positive thing.
So are you bringing your band with you to this gig at the Youth Theater, or is it just you?
No, it's not just me. I've been doing some gigs, some duet gigs with my bass player, John Gagan, who will bring his fabulous upright bass. So it'll be upright bass and flamenco guitar.
So he's been with you since the beginning, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. You know, since 1989, 30 years.
Talk about the interplay between your guitar and his bass. It sounds like there's opportunities for improvisation, like a jazz player.
Lots. You know, yeah, we can do lots of improvisation. It's like any relationship. After a while, you can sort of finish each other's sentences, and that's kind of musically what we're able to do. He has an idea of where I might want to take something, and I know that he can go there with me, or sometimes he goes someplace and I can follow him. And that's really, to me, what makes a live performance enjoyable. I don't enjoy when somebody plays, you know, their hits and they're exactly note for note what's on the record. I've grown up in a time when, you know, people took a few leaps and did a few different things. So these duet shows will also give people an idea of just a different way of hearing some of the same material presented a little differently, which I think is very interesting.
Another section of your blog talks about nail care, which I never really thought about, but I guess it makes perfect sense that a flamenco guitarist has to take care of his nails, at least on his right hand.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's two reasons to fortify one's nails. One is that, you know, you don't want to have that accidental, you know, you're opening a door and a nail rips off, or you're shutting a drawer and you're getting a nail stuck and it breaks off. And the other reason is that especially when you play with other musicians, you want to produce a sound that is strong enough, and there, at least for me, it helps to have the nail a little fortified, a little stronger. So yeah, there's always experimentation with what might be best. And I wrote a little bit about the different nail care strategies I've had in the past decades.
So it sounds like you have to live your daily life in a pretty mindful way in order to avoid those nail tragedies.
I don't think I'm alone, but I definitely have become ambidextrous over the last 30, 40 years, because very early on I started opening all doors and drawers and everything with my left hand, just simply to protect my right hand. So that's just become, you know, part of how I do things. But yeah, you do end up becoming a little more conscious of what you pick up, what you do with your right hand, just to protect it a little more.
Speaking of mindful, I see you were ordained as a Zen monk some years ago, and you talk a little bit about the practice of Zen and the practice of guitar playing for you pretty much being hard to tell the difference between the two.
Yeah, I think it's like anything. When you do things for a certain amount of time, whether it's carpentry or playing guitar or meditation, it just becomes, what's the right word for it? It becomes intimate. It becomes, second nature. And I've played guitar since I was 12 years old, and I've been meditating since I was 15. So those two seem really kind of connected at a root somewhere. I frankly can't imagine my life without either of them.
Interesting. One of the tenets of Buddhism, Zen, that I'm familiar with is Zen mind, beginner's mind. And you just mentioned how long you've been doing both. Is that how do you institute, or how do you incorporate that feeling into your practice,
right,
having done it so long?
Well, I think it's what Picasso referred to as painting like a child, and how long it took him to paint like a child, that there is this, like, it seems like a contradiction. You've done something for a long time, so how can it be beginner's mind? But there is a way to make those two things work. They seem contradictory, but they really aren't. The practice gives you the experience to look at it afresh, which is, it sounds contradictory, but it really isn't.
It sounds like,
you know, maybe you can take, you know, cooking, you know, the more you cook, the more you can improvise with it and do something new with it. So again, the practice just becomes the springboard to experience something fresh,
which is the moment.
Right.
So
that's all there is, right?
It sounds like it might be a dynamic of learning how to get out of your own way.
Yeah. And I think it's a dynamic that we all know, or maybe remember from being children. It's later that we, you know, for lack of a better word, calcify and believe, you know, have these strong opinions about all kinds of things. That sometimes I think hinder us.
Interesting. When you're right, you know, when I think of flamenco, I think of Duende, and I think of Lorca,
right,
and I think of intense passion.
Right.
Is that your experience of what you do?
I don't think I would be considered a very passionate proponent of music. I am more sort of laid back, I am not into being the fastest. I am not into being the loudest. I just enjoy making music and playing guitar. I'm not sure. Yeah, like I said, I don't think maybe we can put it this way. It's a quiet passion with me.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, and you know, part of that for me, at least listening to your music, and I remember when Nouveau Flamenco landed at KD&K, 1990. You know, it exploded. Everybody played it. It didn't matter, you know, what kind of show they did. And I think it's partly because of the melody that's inherent in that release. You have a fine sense of melody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if somebody asked me what's the one constant in all of the different music you've made, and I would probably say it's the melody more than anything else.
Huh. Yeah.
You know, and I sometimes play these games with myself where I basically record a finished track, only I haven't even begun to create a melody for it. So sometimes the whole piece of music is recorded as a series of chords, and then I love just sitting down and coming up with a melody. And it just it never frightens me that there is all this work that has gone into making this recording, and now what if I fail at coming up with a melody? Because in my experience, I'll always come up with something.
So you've gone to that well so many times, but it's deep enough to keep feeding you.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Marlene,
I think all creatives get to the point where you feel emptied out and you feel like I can't possibly come up with something. But I think over time, we also discover that we just need to trust it. And then, you know, it returns, whether it's a few days later or a few weeks later, but you know, the well gets replenished.
Is the performing part of what you do different than the composing part of what you do? Are they two sides of the same coin? How does that work?
Well, I think the major difference is between recording and performing. Recording is where I'd say most of the composing comes from. And it's obviously a much more controlled environment unless you do a live recording. Whereas a live performance really has to be in the moment. They're really different, two very different sides of a coin. I really like both. I like this taking a chance life and trying something and going along with that. And I also like, you know, in the studio, sweating for days over the exact placement of where I want that guitar or that bass to be, or that, drum, or this effect. Do I want it to come from the right, from the left? Where should it be? So it's, you know, that's something I don't worry about live. There's usually an engineer who deals with that. But in recordings, I get to really, create an image of where the different instruments come from. So, you know, they're two very different things, and I really enjoy both very much.
Where do you see you and your music going in the next decade? Or for the rest of your life, for that matter.
Well, that's the fun part. I never know.
All right. I love that.
Recently, I've gotten into a lot of West African music, which also kind of makes sense, because if you look at, the Arabs were all over, you know, Spain, but also North Africa, and then also went down on the west coast of Africa. You've got Mali and other places, and I've been listening a lot to music from that region, just the sensibility and the way the music sounds. So
yeah,
we'll see what that will do in the next year or two.
I love acoustic West African music. I you know, you just described that, and I thought of the band Songhai. Do you remember that band?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also, I think in the early 90s sometime, I played duets with a guy named Fode Musa Suso, he's a musician, I believe, from Mali, who plays kora, and who actually did a lovely album with Herbie Hancock sometime in the, I believe, 70s or 80s.
Uh-huh.
But we did a couple of performances in San Francisco that I really enjoyed a great deal. So it's something that's sort of been in the back of my head for a long, long time.
And that music that Ali Farka Touré made with Ry Cooder and others,
Tumani
Diabate,
yep.
Gorgeous
yep.
Stuff. That's like the soundtrack to heaven.
I was there was a place in the early 90s on Melrose Street, in Los Angeles, and it was called the Speakeasy. And one night I was there having dinner, and it was run by a bunch of guys from France. And on a table was a chair in the middle of the room. There was a table, and on the table was a chair, and on the chair sat a guy. And I'm listening to him, and I'm looking at him like, that's Tumani Diabate. So I knew the French guys that owned the place, and I went up to one of them. Is that Tumani? And he goes, yeah, he's in town for something else, and he decided he wanted to play tonight. He's off tonight, and he's playing here. And I tell you, it was fabulous. The food, and then Tumani. It was a great evening.
Yeah, night to remember. That's a great story. Yeah. Otmar Liebert, I want to thank you for spending a half hour with us on a snowy morning.
My pleasure.
And look forward to seeing you at the Youth Theater in Rifle.
Sounds great. I'll be there.
Break a leg. No, don't do that.
Break
a nail.
Well, do you know where the word break a leg comes from?
No, tell me.
It used to be that stages used to always dip towards the audience, so that the audience, because they didn't used to raise the audience up in the back, right? So that the audience could see more, the stage was slanted quite a bit towards the audience. And so when you moved around and you didn't watch it, you could easily break a leg, especially if it was a dance performance.
Yes.
That's where that comes from.
Oh, wow. Well, I won't say break a nail either, but I look forward to
seeing you.
I look forward to seeing you in Rifle.